You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Boisson.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out how yoga can help prevent falls as we get older.
First, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards spent a year looking at the issue of high rates of student turnover, what can cause it, and what impact it has on students, parents, teachers, and schools.
Today, we hear from a Milwaukee family that she got to know. They went through a transition between second and third grade. And even though it was planned and they had the time and resources to manage it, it wasn't always easy.
Aquila Battle and her twin eighth grade boys, Nathan and Nicholas, joined us from our Milwaukee studios earlier this month to talk about their transition from School for Early Development and Achievement to Milwaukee College Prep. So Aquila, Nathan and Nicholas had to change schools between second and third grade. Why was that?
Well, the School for Early Development and Achievement, which is the school that they were going to since K-4, only went up to a second grade. So great school, small school, but the facility that they were using at the Milwaukee Center for Independence didn't have room for them to add any more grades on. So we only got them up until a second grade.
So as a parent, was it hard to have to start over in understanding how that new school worked and kind of the culture there?
Yes, it was. It was hard in the beginning because we came from a small school with probably about maybe 10 or 15 children in their classroom. Mm. The building was small. It was just a small area. And then we walked into Milwaukee College Prep, 38th Street, and it was huge. Big classrooms, a lot more students in the classroom. And that was a little intimidating. I went into mother bear mode and felt very protective of my children going into this new school. So, but yeah, it was very different than where we had come from.
And it sounds like, I mean, you must have seen it coming that, you know, after second grade, Nathan and Nicholas were going to need to move. So it was something you were able to plan for, at least saw coming. And still, it was difficult. I'm guessing that for a parent who maybe has to make that change unexpectedly, it would be even harder.
Oh, I couldn't even imagine having to just relocate or find a new school for my children to go to at the last minute, not having things planned out. For me and my husband, we did a lot of research. We, you know, went on greatschools.com. We talked to friends and family members that were affiliated with certain schools around the city, and that really prepared us. I'm not sure it would have been even more overwhelming if I didn't have those resources.
So let's turn to Nathan and Nicholas, who are there with their mom. Nathan, why don't you start? What did it feel like to be the new kid at a school 5 years ago in a much bigger school?
It was very scary. I wasn't truly prepared. All I really had was Nick. The beginning few days, I didn't talk to anyone, and I was so scared. I did my work, and it was, like, silent. I wasn't truly paying attention because I was focused on who I was going to talk to and what groups I would be able to fit into during, like, lunch and recess and stuff.
And Nicholas, how was it with your studies? Was what you did up through second grade, were you ready for what they were doing in third grade?
Honestly, I felt very prepared for what we were learning in third grade at MCP. But there was some difficulty there because having known everything, you might be called like a nerd or something along those lines, and it was kind of harder to relate with your friends if you're a bit farther ahead with them.
So you might not want to raise your hand even if you know, because you don't want to stick out as like the smarty pants in the class.
Yes, exactly.
So Nathan, you mentioned, you know, not knowing who you're going to play with or maybe eat lunch with. How did you go about making friends? Because I'm guessing a lot of those kids had already been in school together.
In third grade, most of the time what I'd do is, like, during recess and lunch, I'd see, like, kind of hear in on whatever they're talking about, see if I could relate to that, like, what shows or games that they would be talking about, or Another thing I did was I helped those who needed help in class just as a little extra.
Oh, so you kind of offered to help them with their assignments or something like that?
Yeah.
And what about you, Nicholas? How did you go about making friends?
So there are many nice people in the class, and like I would help them. In agreement with Nate, we did similar things to try to get friends, but when I didn't have friends, I knew I could always talk to Nate, and he would help me out too.
So having your brother there was a nice bonus.
Yeah, everybody talks to the twins.
So, Aquila, were there things that you and your husband did to try and help your boys adjust to this new school?
Yes. For me, I would drop off Nicholas and Nathan at school every morning, and my husband would do the pickup. The wonderful thing about the new school that we found, Milwaukee College Prep, 38th Street, was that they have this morning assembly where they recognize students who are doing well. They go through attendance goals and life's work goals, which is their name for homework, which was different for us. And they even do scholar showcases and things like that. So what I decided to do for at least the first couple of months at their new school, because again, it was a big school, I just felt it was overwhelming for me. I'm sure it's just as overwhelming for Nicholas and Nathan. So I just decided to kind of stick close. The parents were always allowed, or they wanted the parents to kind of stick around and enjoy this morning assembly time with the students, kind of to get your day going. And it was really energizing. So I always stayed, but I was just always in view of them where they can turn around and wave at me and see a familiar face in the audience, because they didn't know anyone there, yeah. And neither did I. So I was at the school quite often, and thankfully the teachers and the principal, they loved that. They loved having parents around and being involved. So in an effort to try to get them more acclimated and feel more comfortable with their new school, I gained great relationships with the principals and the teachers because I was just always there. So that was just my way of just saying, okay, you're not alone. We're all in this together at this new school. And I found soon after a couple of weeks or so, they weren't looking in the audience for me anymore because they found friends and people that they could talk to after a couple of weeks of going to the school.
That must have felt good for you.
It was amazing. It was really great. And the teachers were always, they always embraced them. They were just so kind and warm and welcoming. So that made me feel like, oh, they're in great hands, even if there's one morning that I just can't stay, you know.
We're talking with Mom Aquila Battle and her twin eighth grade boys, Nathan and Nicholas, about experiences moving from one school to another in early grade school and what that was like. And Nathan and Nicholas, I want to go back to you two. When there is a new kid who arrives in your class, what have you noticed about them trying to settle in and how easily it goes? Nicholas, why don't you start?
When we see a new kid come to the class, I always try to greet them and join in, but it may not seem like the entire class is so eager to talk to them, which makes it kind of hard as a new kid because nobody knows you there and nobody's quite eager to get to know you.
And Nathan, what do you think it would be like if a student had to join in the middle of the year and wasn't ready, if they were behind?
That would definitely be much harder because you're stacking academics and social against them, and it just makes them not want to be there even more. Like, we were lucky enough to be ready for the academics when we came, but if somebody weren't ready, then it would be even harder on them.
And Aquila, you mentioned that you and your husband did research, you know, checked out schools, asked other families, you know, what experiences they had had. You know, one of the things that Erin Richards has been looking at in her research for a year now is the issue of student turnover. And it sounds like from what she found, it's not easy to figure out for parents what kind of turnover schools have. Is that something that you ran into?
I believe that is absolutely true. I have to say that that information is not readily available. And when my husband and I were looking for a new school, we didn't really know what sites to go for, what was reputable. The only reason why we, you know, really got good information about that is because I had an aunt that put in over 10 years in with Milwaukee Public Schools. So no, I don't know too many people who have that type of resource. So that really kind of steered us in the right direction as far as figuring out statistics for certain schools, as far as the diversity, the academics, their grade, different clubs or extracurricular activities they may have to offer the students.
Aquila, what do you think schools could do to help parents in a transition like this?
Well, I know for us, academics was extremely important because that was, you know, they came from a school that really catered to their growth academically. But what was equally as important was having a connection between the students and the teachers and the students and the principal, having that kind of nurturing environment. I think that the grades could probably get you there, the type of grade that the school has, but that will keep you there. The nurturing environment will keep you there. So I think for new students, especially those who come in the middle of the year, and even those who come new at the beginning of the year, I think it's important to have some sort of maybe welcoming committee, and it should consist of parents and a few staff members that can track the students maybe for the first 2 weeks of school, just to make sure everything is going okay, that they have everything that they need, and that you're not losing them again to another school. And it may only maybe a week or two, but just so that they know that we're glad to have you at our school and we want to keep you here, and this is how we're going to do that. I think for me, that would make me feel just a part of something. And I, you know, that's what it's all about, is feeling a part of something, or feeling like someone wants you to be a part of it.
And Nathan, what do you think a teacher maybe, or maybe a principal could do to make a student who's coming into a school as the new kid feel more welcome and feel ready to learn?
I say the number one priority a teacher should have, or a principal should have, when a new student comes is to make sure that they feel like they're accepted there, like everyone there wants them there. Because if that's the case, then like the school could be like the scholar's second home and they'd feel amazing there. I know that's why we love MCP, because it's like a second home. And we always feel welcome. There's so many friends that we have there. And it's just always a fun time to go to school because of MCP.
And Nathan, you and your brother will be starting high school next year. What do you think you've learned about being a new kid once that will help you adjust in high school?
I know, for starters, in high school, I just have to be out there. I have to greet people. Because in freshman class, we're not the only people that are new. It's everybody's new. So just making people feel welcome will, one, make me seem like a friendly person, which I am. And I'll try to make those in the class feel welcome as well. Because that is a number one priority of a school to me, other than learning and education.
Well, Nathan and Nicholas, you are two pretty amazing young men. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And Aquila, thank you so much for bringing them in, and thanks for sharing your thoughts, too.
Of course. Thank you so much.
Aquila Battle and her twin eighth-grade boys, Nathan and Nicholas, joined us from our Milwaukee studios earlier this month to talk about what it's like to transition from one school to another.
Coming up, yoga improves balance, and that can prevent falls as we get older. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, an argument for opera as great entertainment for anyone.
Right now, every year, millions of people 65 and older fall. And while most falls don't cause injuries, one out of five does lead to serious complications.
And Wisconsin has one of the highest rates of death from unintentional falls in the nation. We're at twice the national average.
Dr. Irene Hamrick is a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who studied how yoga practice can improve balance and reduce falls for seniors. Dr. Hamrick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into this research on yoga and falls, can you talk about the importance of dealing with this issue of falls itself? Why is this so important?
Yeah, one third of older adults over 65 fall each year, and that number increases to 50% at age 80 and older. So it's very, very common. But patients who sustain a hip fracture from a fall have a 50% chance of dying the following year because it's just so devastating, and a large number of them will not recover enough to live independently by themselves.
And why did you decide to research yoga in particular, and a particular kind of yoga, Hatha or Hatha yoga?
Yeah, so the yoga we chose is also called chair yoga. So it does not require the participant to get onto the floor, and the poses all can be done in a standing position while holding on to a chair or another surface like the wall. So it was much more acceptable. However, in future studies, we might want to include the floor because one of the reviewers, when we submitted it for publication, stated that as patients fall, they really need to learn how to get up from the floor. So having floor yoga included might also give them the tools to get up from a fall, should that happen.
And how much of this yoga did study participants do?
They participated in the class twice a week for 8 weeks, and it was an hour-long class. And then we split the group. There were 38 participants, and we split half of them to do home exercises of yoga and the other one, including meditation and breathing exercises, and the other half did only the meditation and breathing exercises, not the yoga poses at home, because we wanted to see if there was a difference between before and after, but also between the groups to see if those who practiced at home would have better outcomes.
We're talking to Dr. Irene Hamrick from UW-Madison, looking at the idea of using yoga to help prevent falls among people 65 and older. So Dr. Hamrick, they did these yoga poses. They had a little bit of variation in what they did. What did you find? What were the results in terms of balance and fall prevention?
So we showed improvement in all balance and strength parameters that we measured, such as the Berg balance test and a number of other measures. But in addition to these intermediary measures, we also found falls reduction.
How much? How much of a difference did this seem to make?
So we had initially, we asked patients how much they had fallen before the study started. So in the 6 months before the study, 15 participants reported 27 falls. After the intervention, and we started counting and at the onset of the classes because our study was rather short in funding. So we started when classes started and then counted 6 months, and 13 participants had 14 falls over those 6 months, so an almost 50% reduction.
So what is it about yoga that would be helping people have better balance and avoid falls? Is it the physical activity? Is it being more conscious of what you're doing? Do we know why this would work?
That's an excellent question, and we don't really know. It was particularly interesting that the home exercise group did not improve any more than the group that did not practice at home. So just showing up for the class might be enough to stimulate the brain-muscle connection to improve balance and reduce falls. But we had a small study, so this really needs to be replicated in a larger study. But when we asked participants what they thought made the difference, they said, I'm much more aware of the 4 points of my foot on the floor. So it might have also been more the awareness, but we also don't know how much meditation or breathing exercises might have contributed to the improvement in falls. That is all something that needs to be studied further.
This study involved yoga and balance and falls prevention. You've looked at other interventions, too. What kind of things have you studied?
I have, with Dr. Jane Mahoney from the University of Wisconsin, rolled out the program of lifestyle intervention for functional exercise. This was a study done by Dr. Clemson out of Australia that integrated exercises into daily activities. Most of us who participate in classes for falls reduction will oftentimes do the exercises while we're doing the class, but after the class stops, we tend to not continue the exercises at home, and then the effect wanes over time. So Dr. Clemson's premise was, if we integrate exercise into daily activities, we're more likely to continue them afterwards. Plus, people are more likely to do them if it doesn't take any extra additional time. So, for example, while brushing our teeth, we balance on one leg, or while we're wiping the table, we partially squat to build our quadricep muscles for balance. And, for example, while I do emails, I spend a lot of time in front of the computer, I partially squat and lean to all four directions to reach the limit of my sway to increase my balance muscles.
That's fascinating, because I think a lot of people, I'll include myself here, we think if I'm going to do some form of exercise, it means I have to set aside time for it. There might be equipment. I might have to go to a gym. And that means in many cases, I just don't do it. So it sounds like this plan would help people integrate it into their daily lives.
Exactly. So we're hoping to increase the repertoire that we can offer to patients if they are at risk of falls to prevent future falls, because some patients might want to do yoga, others might not, and they might need to integrate their exercise into daily activities because they have a very busy schedule.
How much of this is a mindset issue? As I get older, I imagine I'll be less interested in doing physical activity. It might not be on my radar. How important is it just to get people thinking, hey, if I do this physical activity, even at a limited level, it's going to make me safer and healthier?
That is an important piece. We really have to change the mindset of all of us, because more and more data is coming out of the benefits of exercise for everything from cancer to preventing dementia, and of course, falls.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Hamrick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Irene Hamrick is a professor of family medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She shared how practicing yoga can help prevent falls as we get older.
Coming up, opera hasn't always been a highbrow form of entertainment. Our next guest makes the case for opera being worth a listen and having something to offer for everyone. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening to a little of Wagner's prelude to the opera, The Valkyrie. Opera has been around for over 400 years, and it's brought just about every human emotion and a wide range of stories to audiences ranging from royalty to everyday people.
Our next guest makes the case for both traditional and modern opera as a form of entertainment that just about everyone can enjoy. And we want to hear from you. Are you an opera fan? Who or what got you started? Have you tried to share your love of opera with others? How successful have you been? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
Vivian Schweitzer is a pianist and music critic. Her new book is A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera. Vivian, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's start with a really basic question. What makes an opera an opera? What is it?
The one thing that's very unique about opera is the voice. There's some things, elements of opera that are quite similar to musical theater, for example. But what really distinguishes opera is the sound of the unamplified voice. It's pretty rare, I think, in any form of vocal music in other genres to have singers who essentially use no amplification. So that's one thing that's very special about opera. Basically, it's the sound of the unamplified voice.
And you're probably getting asked about this a lot as you come out with this book. A lot of people look at opera and they think that's a highbrow thing, or if I go, it's a chore, you know, like making somebody eat overboiled broccoli or something like that. Mm-hmm. You are really making the case that, no, it has been and can be something for everyone. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. I think opera is very unfairly stereotyped as this kind of elitist thing, you know, only for certain people, and that most people can't enjoy it and you have to have a special education or whatever. And perhaps that's partly because opera did originate as a form of entertainment for royalty. But since then, it's also been a form of entertainment for the masses, and it's kind of swung both ways. And I think what's interesting these days is there's so much going on in the opera world that you really can find a form of it that appeals to you. So if you prefer not, for example, to go to an enormous traditional theater, you know, you can find a local opera company that's probably doing really interesting things and modern productions. But most importantly, you still get to enjoy the most important thing about opera, which is the sound of the voice.
For someone who doesn't have a background with opera at all, what's a good entry point? What's a good starting point for them to check it out, find something they'll appreciate, and starts to lure them in further?
I would definitely recommend operas like Rigoletto, Carmen, The Magic Flute, The Marriage of Figaro. These are the operas that most opera companies perform again and again, and there's good reason, because there are operas that include some of the most gorgeous music ever written. The plots are, by operatic standards, relatively straightforward, because as you probably know, sometimes operas get somewhat complex in terms of the plots. So these operas have plots that are more straightforward than others. And the music's beautiful, which is why they are in the repertory of so many opera companies. So yeah, Rigoletto and Carmen, La Traviata. Those are all good ones to start with.
Talking to Vivian Schweitzer, author of A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera. A lot of your book, you talk about the history of opera, and I want to go back to the early days and give a listen to a piece, L'Orfeo by Monteverdi. Here's a listen. Mm-hmm. So you write this wasn't really the first opera, but it was the first one that really caught on. Can you talk about it a little?
Exactly. What Monteverdi did that was different was that he created sung drama that really had an emotional impact. So he definitely wasn't the first person to set words to music. But he was the first person to do so in a way that really, really kind of affected people emotionally. So there were composers before him, Jacopo Peri, for example, who also created opera, but they somehow didn't make the same impact. So what Monteverdi did and his genius was to create a form of sung drama that really resonated, that had people in tears, that somehow impacted them in a way that previous works in the genre hadn't. So, for example, you know, there are reports of people breaking down in tears at first performances of his work, and something about the way that he set words to music was very powerful. And you can just hear from that tiny snippet.
And speaking of emotion in opera, you introduced me to a phrase I wasn't familiar with, but I love it, the rage aria. Can you talk about that?
Well, rage arias are, as you know, opera characters are often angry about something, or they're frequently feeling betrayed, and they're often feeling betrayed with very good reason, because somebody's just done something terrible to them or run off with someone else, or they're heartbroken. So rage arias were an important part of a Baroque genre of opera called opera seria. And Handel, for example, wrote a lot of fabulous rage arias where the characters just kind of vent and lament and emote, and you just feel their anxiety so deeply.
I want to give a listen to another piece now. And this is one you mentioned, actually, Mozart and the Magic Flute. Here's a taste of that.
In a Vogelfänger bin ich ja stets lustig, heißa hopsasa, ihr Vogelfänger ist bekannt, alt und jung im ganzen Land. Weiß mit dem Locken umzugehen und mich aufs Pfeifen zu verstehen. Drum kann ich froh und lustig sein, denn alle Vögel sind ja mein.
So those earlier days, the operas, you write, were really that elite audience. Is it by Mozart's time that we're starting to see a more mass appeal in the opera?
Yes. And also in Mozart's time, he did something that was with, for example, The Marriage of Figaro. He actually dared to rebel against the authorities. A lot of the operas written before Mozart were very deferential to the people who commissioned them. I mean, Monteverdi, for example, was employed by the court, as was Mozart's librettist. But what Mozart did during the time when he wrote The Marriage of Figaro is he actually dared to kind of express this, you know, minor rebellion against the authorities, which was fairly notable at the time.
And there were worries at some points, cultural commentators saying, oh, I'm worried this opera, this is getting too populist. The common people are liking it. And that's wrong.
Right. So basically, in the opera world, you've had this kind of strange situation where it's the pendulum has really swung between opera being this thing that was commissioned for and performed for royalty. And then it somehow became a little more popular. And then you had various very lofty and somber and important academics saying, oh, no, we mustn't have this. We have to keep it pure and elitist. And, you know, we don't want the common masses listening to this. And then in the 19th and early 20th century, it became much more popular. And you had singers like Caruso, who gave the first Metropolitan Opera radio broadcast and reached enormous audiences. And then later in the 20th century, I think the pendulum's kind of swung back a little bit, and it's deemed again as somewhat elitist.
How about women in opera? I know Shakespeare, and you write about the comparison, Shakespeare could write parts for women, but boys had to play them because they couldn't be up on stage. What were there similar things with opera over the years?
Yes, there were. So at the beginning of opera, back in the 17th century, you had this very unfortunate tradition of the castrati, which basically were young boys who'd been castrated before puberty to ensure that their voices never broke. And the reason that this horrible thing was done was because women weren't allowed to sing publicly. So they had to have men who had higher voices and kind of balanced out the choirs. Later on, women were allowed to sing, and interestingly, opera was actually one of the few avenues that women had to earning their own money, you know, at a time when women weren't allowed to own property or really had no rights at all. Some of the famous, some of the best-known women singers at the era were actually pretty successful in their own right.
Vivian Schweitzer is with us. She's a pianist and former music critic for the New York Times. Her new book is called A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a fan of opera? What do you love about it? Do you have a favorite composer, singer, or even director? Make the case for others to give opera a listen. Or do you avoid opera at all costs? What would it take for you to give it a try? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We continue our conversation with Vivian Schweitzer about her book, A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera. And in case you don't know, during the Metropolitan Opera season, you can hear performances on WPR's News and Classical Music Network, either on air or online at WPR.org.
What about you? Do you enjoy seeing opera performed live on stage? Have you ever gone to one of the live broadcasts in movie theaters? Or do you listen to opera on Wisconsin Public Radio? If you can't imagine enjoying opera, what would it take to give it a try? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Vivian, we're going to skip a bunch of history here. I want to give a taste of more modern, contemporary opera. Here's a listen. This is one I think you mentioned in your book, Powder Her Face. This is a 1995 opera by a British composer, Thomas Addis. Here's a listen. Starts with a bit of a scream.
Madam, I am the manager.
You must
have been expecting.
No, I have not been expecting you. I did not ask to see you.
Must have read the letters we have sent you, madam.
I have not.
You.
So, Vivian, when we think of opera, we might think of Mozart or Verdi or, you know, things from a long time ago. New opera is still happening, right?
New opera is definitely still happening. Contemporary composers aren't composing perhaps as much as their predecessors, who were really churning out dozens and dozens and dozens of operas, some of them. But there have been some really terrific operas written in the last few years. And I think it's important to note that opera is very much a contemporary art form as well. And I can think of, you know, there's at least five or six operas composed pretty recently that I thought were excellent. Missy Mazzoli's Breaking the Waves. There was an opera, Bel Canto, based on the Anne Patchett book. We had an opera called Fellow Travelers by a composer called Gregory Spears. I mean, really quite an impressive number of new operas that I think have resonated and seem to have kind of stuck around. Because the other problem with contemporary opera is sometimes there's a lot of expectation and build up for the premiere, and then the work is never performed again. That's definitely an issue.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Madison. Bob, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to opera since I was 17. The first one was Carmen, and I'm still a big fan of Carmen, but I've progressed through Wagner and then on to John Adams. Maybe John Adams, then Wagner. But I really love how the music portrays characters and the stories that are told with the lyrics and the music simultaneously.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Vivian, can you talk about that, how the story, the lyrics, and the music all come together?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's nailed it. You know, that's one of the most incredible things about opera is how composers use the voice and music to tell a story and also to create a lot of nuance, you know, with a character, say, like Rigoletto, for example, who has a very different private persona from his public persona, or Violetta in La Traviata, and just to create all kinds of nuance in the interactions between these characters and the way the story unfolds, and to sometimes surprise us. You know, I think sometimes people are surprised that, for example, in opera, you know, the bad guys, bad people in general, get to sing beautiful music. It's not like a movie where you have, you know, the cinematic villain comes on and there's kind of the stereotypical spooky cinema bad guy music. You know, it's much more nuanced, I think, often in opera.
Thanks for that call, Bob. So one obstacle might be, hey, a lot of these are in different languages, not English, for example. How can we do our homework so we get what's going on in the story, even if it's a language we don't speak?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually love listening to opera in foreign languages. I'm not a big fan of English translation in general. I can completely understand why an opera company might do that, because it seems somehow it would seem to render the opera more accessible if it's in a language that the local audience can understand. But I think even when a singer is singing in English, and even if they have impeccable diction, you're still going to need the subtitles anyway. So for me, one of the treats of opera is getting to listen to all these languages, like Czech, for example, that I don't normally listen to, but I love the sound of Czech. So I love going to an opera in Czech. So the important thing, I think, is just to make sure you have a general idea of the plot before going, and then you'll have the subtitles. So even if you know, you forget what's happening in Act 3, Scene 4, the subtitles are right there to fill you in. But I think language should be savored as a kind of musical element of the opera.
Thanks.
And something that's integral to it.
We'll go to another caller now. Will is with us in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Will, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Okay, I don't hate opera, but I'm not a big fan, but I just wanted to plug my cousin. She's a pretty good opera singer. she's from Milwaukee. Emily Fons, F-O-N-S. Okay. I don't know if anybody's heard of her. I know she's sung across the entire world, but knowing that there's somebody from Wisconsin, maybe that will interest some more people into going to shows. I know she has sung recently in Milwaukee, but I wasn't able to make the show.
So you will check out opera, at least if your cousin's in it, though, Will, right?
Oh, yep. No, I'm friends with her on Facebook on her page, and you can listen to little samples of her and stuff like that. I know she's amazing.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. And actually, that reminds me, Vivian, I wanted to ask, we talked about contemporary composers. There's a big opera scene out there of performers, too, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, there's definitely a kind of trend of nostalgia in the opera world. And I guess there's, you know, nostalgia is something that's pervasive to many, many, many genres and spheres of our life. But I think while there were certainly some extraordinary singers in the past, it is very important to note there are lots of wonderful, really wonderful singers performing today. You know, I'm very excited to hear Anna Netrebko sing in Aida. There are lots and lots of singers there of all different genres who are, I think, very powerful.
Thanks a lot for that call. Good luck to your cousin. I want to not forget to talk about this. You put together, Vivian, a Spotify playlist to go along with your book, A Mad Love. Talk about the range. There's a lot of music on this.
There's a lot of music. Yes, you'll probably notice the book, especially as opera books go, is very short. The playlist is definitely quite Wagnerian, and I think it actually clocks in at 17 hours, which is just about the length of the Ring cycle. But I wanted to include music not only from operas that I think people would easily have a chance to see, such as Carmen, Bohème, Traviata, all the hit operas, but also from operas that you might not have a chance to see staged live very often, such as a Rameau opera or a Messiaen's opera, just to give a flavor of all the different ways that composers used music to tell a story. So I think if you start at the beginning with Monteverdi and Orfeo, and then you go through and I have Rameau and then Gluck and Mozart and basically everyone up to about 7 or 8 contemporary composers, I think you'll hopefully get a real flavor of the extraordinarily eclectic and amazing ways that composers have created sung drama. And then, of course, if one composer speaks to you more, then, you know, you can Google around for them.
As someone who's seen and listened to a lot of opera, when you're just listening, you know, on a CD or online or whatever, do you feel that absence, not having the visual spectacle?
Not always. I mean, you know, sometimes, but definitely not always. And if you're listening to an amazing singer and assuming you have, you know, reasonably good headphones or stereo system, no, sometimes you don't. And I think that's the other point. You know, there's so many different ways to enjoy opera. Obviously, going to the theater and experiencing it live is one main way. But you can also listen to the broadcasts and you can listen online. There are lots of different ways I think you can have a powerful experience listening to the human voice.
In our last minute or so, what is your current jam? What are you really loving to listen to lately?
In terms of just which operas?
Yeah, anything you're into right now.
What am I listening to right now? I've been listening to a lot of Philip Glass recently, Satyagraha again, which is one of my very, very, very favorite operas. And I've been listening to a lot of Alcina, I think, because I have I have Alcina on my Spotify playlist. So there are a couple of arias that I seem to have on repeat and I can't quite get enough of because it's gorgeous music.
Wonderful. Vivian, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Pianist and music critic Vivian Schweitzer was with us to talk about her new book, A Mad Love, An Introduction to Opera.
Don't forget that during the Metropolitan Opera season, you can hear performances on WPR's News and Classical Music Network, either on air or online at WPR.org. Si ricovia de refuser, io ne femmina soprir, lo parlo bien, l'autre se tait, c'est l'autre que je prête.
scientists in Antarctica make amazing discoveries all the time, but recently they made one that they weren't even looking for.
It turns out that several years ago, researchers planted sensors in the huge ice shelf that floats in the Southern Ocean off of the shore of the continent. The goal was to measure seismic activity.
But what they didn't expect was to record the ice shelf singing. Here's some of what they picked up.
The researchers realized that the top layer of the ice shelf, which has a rough texture, was vibrating almost constantly. And the tones that were produced changed depending on a whole bunch of different factors, including changing temperatures and storms reshaping the surface of the ice.
One of the scientists poetically described it as, quote, the buzz produced by thousands of cicada bugs when they overrun the tree canopy and grasses in late summer.
But another researcher said it was a little like yodeling, except with 10 people all singing in dissonance. It's a little eerie. It is a little eerie, Rob.
Yeah, and we've got the WPR 10-person choir in here to reenact. Oh, I forgot to bring the choir in. I wanted to hear that 10 dissonant yodelers at once.
Well, maybe some other time here on Central Time.